Today's program was brought to you by the Brooklyn Kitchen, a mom-and-pop operation since 2006. They provide the tools that shape our food culture. Visit them at 100 Frost Street in Williamsburg, Brooklyn, or visit thebrooklynkitchen.com.
I'm Dave Arnold, host of Cooking Issues. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Welcome to The Front Burner with Jimmy and Andrew, where we serve a weekly menu of industry commentary based on what the market has to offer. I'm Andrew Friedman from Tokeland.com.
And I'm Jimmy Bradley from The Red Cat.
We have a single topic show today, but it's a huge topic, so we're going to get right to it. We're not going to discuss anything else in the news this week. This is a show that we first said we were going to do in our last live show 2 weeks back, which happened to be the day after the, I guess what I would call the bombshell per se review in the New York Times, in which the restaurant was taken from 4 stars down to 2. That review, obviously, even very publicly, sent a shockwave through the dining world. We're not here to litigate that review or really even to discuss it. I think it's probably, Jimmy, you would agree, it's probably been examined as much as anything since maybe the Zapruder film, I would say.
That's a good one, Andrew.
There's what was interesting sort of behind the scenes and in social media was there were a lot of sort of simmering issues that have been going on, I think, between the chefs and the critics of the world. Things that people talk about maybe over a beer, maybe on Twitter, on their Facebook pages. And there's I think what that review did in some ways, because probably it was such a huge subject in the person of Thomas Keller and the restaurant per se, a lot of these things, I think, kind of boiled over on both sides, I would say. Some of the things that we've heard, and we mentioned this 2 weeks ago, but over and over, as we talk to chefs, cooks, restaurateurs, from that side of it, this sort of increasing question that fine dining is under attack. This feeling that bad reviews are sometimes celebrated, certainly on social media. This feeling that sometimes reviews feel personal, or they feel like more like attacks than reviews. There's an interesting question of whether or not reviews are in and of themselves entertainment, whether that's a function they serve, or should they just be sort of a very objective critique, but without sort of one-liners that people remember and things like this. Are all restaurants treated fairly or equally? Does the star system still apply in today's world? And, you know, also a feeling that there's a growing sense of maybe sensationalism in the way restaurants are covered and reviews are written. That's intended in a changing media world to get page views and eyeballs on the pages and drive traffic. That's something that has been really out there in the industry. And I think it really, like we said, boiled over a few weeks ago. And what we wanted to do today was very simply have some chefs, restaurateur, some food critics, editors, and just talk about this. It seemed like it would be a very productive thing to get some people from both camps to have a dialogue and just examine this whole topic. It's something that, you know, some people's, I think, emotions probably run a little high on, but our intention here is to have, you know, just a civil discussion about this. So the one other thing I'll say going into this is we're not looking to have a consensus. We're just looking to kind of air out both sides and maybe get where everybody's coming from. So with that said, and this is with real special thanks today because it is a bit of a third rail topic, we really appreciate people who have come on to participate. In the studio today, we have restaurateur Drew Neporant of Tribeca Grill, Nobu, more recently, of course, Batard, and countless restaurants. We have Chef Alex Stupak of the Empeon Restaurants in New York City, and we have Chef David Waltek of Elan here in New York. And of course, David will always be associated with the late, great Chanterelle, which had a just about 30-year run in downtown New York City. On the phone, we have New York Times food editor and former restaurant critic Sam Sifton. Hello, Sam.
Hey, how are you guys?
Good. How you doing?
I'm ready to take the sock out of my mouth whenever you want me to talk.
We're just about there. And from Charleston, we have food editor and critic for The Post and Courier and author of the book Yelp, How to Write Great Online Restaurant Reviews, Hannah Raskin. Hannah, are you there?
I am here.
Good morning.
Good Good morning.
And in the second half of the show, we will be joined by Eater New York restaurant critic Ryan Sutton. So having said all of that, Sam, let's start with you, please. I'm sure you probably saw, and everyone here probably saw, that last night Thomas Keller published a response just about everywhere. It was on his Facebook page. It was on Twitter. It was. I got an email that went out to a mailing list, and it's to me it was his answer to this age-old question of how to respond. You know, should is there a place for restaurateurs or chefs to respond to criticism? Is there a place for any kind of a dialogue between these two camps, or are they really two camps and there should be a big wall up between them? And what the chefs and restaurateurs of the world might feel, this list of things I went through at the beginning, you know, does that even matter from the critical side? There have obviously been some other cases recently of people responding. There was the Amos Fakahani letter to Pete Wells. But more broadly, just Sam, I'll throw it out to you in the broadest possible terms. Should there be any kind of a dialogue between chefs and critics? And if so, what's the proper avenue or venue for that to happen? What's the best way for that to be useful to people on your side?
Well, there certainly can be a dialogue between chefs and restaurateurs. I mean, between chefs, restaurateurs, and critics. But it's worth pointing out that we're not in the same business. We're not doing the same thing. And the critic's job is not to work within the industry, as it is called, within the industry, to further the interests of chefs or restaurateurs. It's simply to be an advocate for the diner and to explain what is going on in a given restaurant at a given time, given a series of meals over a period of time. How the restaurateur or how the chef responds to a piece of criticism is, you know, you can do it in a million different ways. I don't think it's necessarily good for anyone to respond with a kind of angry yelp, although we'll take advertisements if you want to take some out in the paper. But I thought Keller's response was very considered and classy and probably the right thing for the Thomas Keller Restaurant Group.
Yeah, I would agree with that. The thing that struck me, it wasn't apparent in not all formats saw this, but what I thought was quite touching for anybody out there who was, you know, wondering if quote unquote heads were going to roll or something like that, was on Thomas's website. There's actually now a dedicated page. If you go to that site, you know, there's biography, timeline, restaurants, and then it says message to our guests is a dedicated link now on the homepage, and that takes you to that letter. And there's a picture of Thomas and Eli Kameh, the chef at Per Se, standing together, which to me was really him, Thomas, saying the buck stops, you know, with me, and you know my team's here and intact, and we're going to get through this together, which I thought was fascinating. Hannah, I'd love to know your thoughts. I saw an interview with you. I think you said something to the effect of, you know, when you came to Charleston in this job, it wasn't to make friends necessarily, but you know, not friendship. But again, I do wonder about this question of I guess I wouldn't even say the feelings of chefs to what Sam was saying, but do the opinions of chefs matter when there starts to be themes coming from the chef side about kind of the state of affairs? Is that something that even, again, I'll just put it out there in the broadest terms, is that something that's a consideration for you?
I mean, I wouldn't say it's a consideration. That it's actually, I would echo what Sam said. I mean, we're in a different business, and so I was actually struck even by the way you framed this question about the relationship between chefs and critics, because I feel my relationship is with my audience first and foremost, with the consumer, and secondarily with the restaurant. And this idea of personalizing the restaurant so that it becomes, you know, emblematic of one man in most cases, I don't think I totally buy into that. I don't think the diner does. In most cases, especially here, we have a lot of, you know, kind of celebrity chefs. The diner doesn't interact with the chef. And so the chef is sort of at a remove. Now, if he still wants to jump into the conversation, I'm all for conversation. I'm all for, you know, a democratic dialogue about ideas. So if he wants to, you know, or she wants to talk about any issues that have been raised, I'm all for it. For me, the more dialogue, the better.
Yeah, I guess just to put a finer point on what I was saying, and then maybe we'll bring some of the chefs in on this conversation. But I guess what I meant is, is it ever useful, or is anyone, and maybe I'll just ask you two before we come into the studio here with our live guests who are here in the room, But, you know, have you ever, and I'm not asking for specifics, but have you ever received an email or a phone call with a chef that maybe explained something about the business or about what they do? You know, economics comes up sometimes. You know, a lot of times chefs will feel like critics will point to certain pricing, but they don't understand the specific situation of their restaurant, so they feel like it's an unfair knock. Have you ever heard from someone in a way that, you know, maybe corrected or changed your thinking about a specific thing that you had written about and made you think, oh, that's interesting, I didn't realize that from my point of view?
Andrew, I've never written, in my time as restaurant critic, I never wrote a negative thing about someone's pricing and then received an edifying email that explained, oh, gee, I'm totally wrong. It was totally legitimate for that guy to charge $95 for X. That didn't happen to me. I will say that, you know, in years of reporting on chefs and on restaurants and on food, I've learned a lot, and that certainly played into my criticism, just as it plays into Pete's and Hannah's and Brian's and every critic's. But I've certainly have learned in interviewing chefs about things, but I've never been put back on my heels by some thing that I didn't know, that, oh, that explains why this bad service is tolerable or why this substandard dish or truly outrageously expensive dish is actually a good deal. That hasn't happened to me.
I agree with Sam totally. I mean, I've learned, as he said, I mean, just to reiterate, a ton from chefs. And I think, you know, the 10 years I spent front of the house just dealing with chefs prior to this career, I learned a lot. I still have a reportorial function, so I learn from chefs all the time. But the reality is, when we do hear back from chefs or restaurateurs, and I would say in my case, it's fairly unusual, what I learn about is... most things I probably couldn't even repeat on the air is what I learn about. You know, I mean, I learn about my mother. I learn about, you know, and nobody ever takes the time to write and explain something like that. Even though they're making that argument for financial reasons, you know, because they're worried about business, it's couched in aesthetics, and it generally comes down to you don't know anything. That's usually the feedback I get.
And Hannah, let's be clear, the vast majority of the correspondence between chefs and critics in the wake of a review is not substantive. It's either angry in the form of, you know, a letter like Fakahani's, or it's considered in the way we saw from Keller, and the considered response is rare. It's occasionally a drunken tweet or a really quickly written angry email, but I don't think that, you know, that this notion that there is a big level of communication between chefs and critics in the wake of reviews is accurate. I don't think it happens that often.
Yeah, that's what I meant to say. I mean, what I hear is just, it's in oftentimes intelligible, and I understand people are very, very angry, but again, I've never received the kind of messaging.
Right. Well, this is why, I'm going to turn this over to Jimmy, but this is, I take the point. It's why when I led into the question, I wanted to make the distinction between feelings and I guess what I would call opinion. So those points are all well taken. Jimmy?
Yeah, I want to bring this point to the people in the restaurant business and David and Drew and Alex. This is a broad topic question, and you know, David and Drew, you have places now, and you've had places for a long time, so feel free to speak as generally as you can to this. I guess this question is to David first, and then to Drew, and then to Alex. You know, have you had relations with critics? What have your relations been with critics, and how has it changed over time?
Well, I've never had any personal relationship with any critic. It feels personal because a review is extremely public, and to sort of disagree in a way with one thing I recently heard, I mean, a restaurant is not, certainly not one person. It's a collaboration. It involves many, many people's work. But it is usually directed by a kind of a vision, let's say, that comes from one or a very limited number of people. So a restaurant is speaking as a chef, it's a very, very personal enterprise. And I, because of my history and who I am, I've never really been able to view it as a purely business enterprise. So even a relatively good or very good review resonates in a way that it's very hard to leave your emotions out of it. So even a good review that has something that I feel is inaccurately reported, or of course a bad review, is something that I don't feel a need to respond to, but it's something that I take very much to heart. And I think all restaurateurs and all chefs, especially chefs, do.
Got it. Drew, can you?
Can I jump in, Jimmy, for a second?
Yes.
Because David raises a really good point, which is that, you know, we started out this discussion by talking about restaurants as a business. And David raises a much more important point, which is that restaurants are also a cultural product. And at their best, the chefs are creating a piece of art or an experience of art that lasts over a period of time that could be 20 minutes or it could be 5 hours. And it seems to me completely understandable that the person with the vision at the center of that artistic endeavor, the chef, is going to have a tremendous personal and perhaps emotional reaction to a negative review or even a positive review that has a little teeth in the eighth paragraph or the like. But I think that tension is an excellent one and an important one. One of the things we know from being journalists is, you know, a lot of times artists are the least capable of expressing what it is that their art is really about. It is just there. It is brilliant. It has changed the world. And we, in our arrogance, critics, believe that maybe we can go in and explain what is happening. Now, this goes more to good reviews, perhaps, than to negative ones. But if you're asking about the relationship between the critic and the chef, at its best, the critic can act as a kind of translator or explainer or reporter who is divining what is going on here culturally as opposed to what is going on here from a business perspective. From a business perspective, of course, if the art has failed on some level, we're going to say it, and that's going to have the reaction. See above. It's going to be a personal and emotional one.
Thank you, Sam. I see someone. I see Drew chomping at the bit. So
I really think that was very clear and very very well spoken. Just to put things in perspective, I opened my first restaurant in '85, but I've been watching this thing really in the '70s when Mimi Sheridan yielded the she was the power that eats, and essentially when we open a restaurant we have no money. I'm talking now, I'm putting things in reference 30 years ago. And most of the time we're on a misbegotten street in Soho.
Downtown.
Or Tribeca. And so this becomes a symbiotic relationship. We need somebody, usually it's customers, to discover us. But the symbiotic relationship between us and the press is very important to understand because they need something to write about. And part of their whole credibility is the discovery, finding us. And at the same time, since we have no money and we cannot advertise, that when a critic comes in, because 30 years ago there was no internet, a critic can change the whole ball game. I mean, when we got 3 stars at Montrachet, I was charging $16 for dinner. David Boulay was the chef. It was the equivalent of winning the lottery without being able to collect the cash. You know, you only had so many seats. But guess what? I wasn't greedy, and 22 years later, that restaurant still existed.
Yeah.
So the point is, I mean, David's point about it's not a business. You know, when we first started out, we didn't look at it that way. And by the way, it's become way too mechanized.
Yeah.
And even Thomas Keller, I would dare say, part of the, and if you really look closely at that review and the way it was broken down, that's really part of the problem.
Yeah, a lot of the fun is gone in the business,
well,
right?
Well, because if you're charging $16, I think it's fair to say that, you know, you shouldn't overanalyze what you're eating. And if it's delicious, God damn it, it's $16 for three courses. Anyway, the only other point I would make is, as a seasoned person in our industry, I don't want to wake up one morning and read my own obituary in the New York Times. So in other words, I made it a point to understand, okay, Mimi Sheridan, you know, how many times does she have to say every shrimp she's ever eaten has iodine in it? So I didn't even put shrimp on the menu at Montrachet. She didn't like the peppermint being thrust in front of her because that was the cliche of fine dining and all that way. So guess what? We put the peppermint on the table. So in many cases, it's again the symbiotic relationship. We're learning from the food community, the writers, the critics, but they're also learning from us when they come to our restaurant, maybe eat something they've never had.
Great points of view, Drew. You know more about this than a lot of us, and thank you for sharing. I want to bring this to Alex now and see what Alex's point of view is on this. Can you elaborate?
Sure. The original question, I don't have any personal relationship with any critic. I have relationships with people who have relationships with critics. But
has anyone corresponded with a critic in writing somehow?
I mean, I've got tremendous relationships.
Yeah. But I mean, meaning direct. I mean, you can be cordial and you communicate, but I still think even in this day and age, because a lot of people suspect, at least in my world, it's still very much separation of church and state. And the way, and what Hannah and Sam both said, they're just different businesses and they're different worlds. One thing I see that is a consistent with negative reviews, it's not always worded this way, is that they are businesses, but when the critic feels like it was a business transaction, meaning they are reminded of what they're paying for it, usually because the service is bad or the food faltered or something. You know what I mean? And that becomes a very interesting point for me. The critic is helpful in my mind because they help us view our own restaurant with harsh objectivity. To the point of what David said, it is emotional and it is personal. But it is also a business, and it is also weird for a chef and an owner, a restaurateur, to sit in their own restaurant and eat and judge it. Either they're going to be overly harsh and they're going to go insane and they're not going to enjoy it, or they're going to think it's the best thing ever because it is their child, it is their baby. So this person is looking at it, the critic, they're looking at it from purely from the guest side, right?
Yeah. Andrew, you want to pick up on another portion?
Yeah, it's funny. I was going to talk a little bit about something else, but I'm going to go to this instead because it's a conversation we actually had just when we were getting ready to come over to the show. But I think a lot of what everyone just said, which is really interesting, is, you know, if you think about popular culture and you think about critics portrayed in popular culture, the two critics by far, when you see a movie or a TV show that are portrayed as sort of, you know, sort of the most stereotypical caricature of sort of the scheming critic, it's not TV critics or movie critics or art critics or music. It's always restaurant critics and theater critics. And I think in real life, that's true. Those are the critics who are really known for kind of zinging people, for coming up with these memorable one-liners. And what's interesting to me is, and I'd love maybe just to go around the horn and then we'll go to our break, but maybe starting with you, Hannah. But what's interesting to me is these are both interactive experiences to some extent, a little less so with theater than a restaurant. But these are places where you have to kind of prove it every day, where the performance is new every day, where the food is cooked and served every day. And critics are having an interactive experience that's different every time. Right. Just by definition. So I'm just wondering, it seems to me that there's a very interesting psychologically, philosophically, personally, there's a very interesting dynamic that's unique to this type of criticism. Hannah, what do you think about that?
No, that's exactly right. You know, I've always been really envious of my colleagues who write about, you know, spirits, because anyone can get a bottle and they can find out, does it taste like it, does it not taste like that? I mean, like, as you say, restaurants and theaters, both of those are performances that unfold every night and they unfold only once. So, you know, if I say this is what happened, that's what happened, you know, and so that I do think that is really tricky, and it does make it more difficult to form any kind of consensus about anything.
Sam?
Oh, boy, but it's awesome, though. I have to say that, you know, there is one difference between restaurant critics and theater critics. The restaurant critic goes a number of times to the restaurant. The theater critic often just takes one on the aisle, and, you know, if Moose Murders was terrible that night, he shuts it right down with some choice one-liners. The restaurant critic has this opportunity to figure out what is actually happening within the realm of the restaurant over the course of a period of time, over the course of a number of meals. And I find this luxury, and it's a luxury that's afforded to the Times, and I'm very thankful for it, and I hope our readers are thankful for it as well. This luxury of time allows us to really kind of think through what is happening at the restaurant and what is really going on in the kitchen or on the plate or in the dining room. This gives the restaurant the opportunity to not screw up that chicken three times in a row, but to maybe have an off night. And that can be allowed within the sort of understanding of the restaurant experience from the critic's point of view. It's a delicious, pardon the pun, form of criticism to me, because we are afforded the time and the hours to really experience the place and try and figure it out on our own terms.
Thanks for that. The other distinction I always make is that, you know, you go to a restaurant and have a bad meal, at least you got fed, right? In theater, you can't say that. You still have to go out to dinner.
I don't know, Andrew. I got a couple meals I can tell you about.
Alex, what do you think about this aspect of it, this sort of live, interactive aspect of this relationship and how it affects things in real time, maybe when a critic is in the house, whether or not you know they're there, and then the after effect of a review, positive or negative, and how it affects kind of your psyche going forward?
Sure. Well, a few things. One, I do believe restaurants at their best are part of the entertainment industry. So I think that the writing that comes along with it isn't just pure journalism or documentation of a moment in time. It's meant to be entertaining as well, right? Restaurants, thinking of them as art, it's tricky. Maybe they're closer to theater in that you have to nail that same performance over and over and over, the consistency game. I actually think they're a lot more personal because people are putting that art in their mouths. They're consuming it and they're digesting it. So the nerves that come up when you, we know what the critics look like. We know what they all look like. So the nerves that come up when that critic was spotted, it can throw you. And I'll be the first to admit, when I opened my first restaurant, when that critic sat down, you know, you're fishing through your drawer to find your best piece of this protein and that protein. As the evolution goes, like, you learn this, it's like you can't switch up your game at the last minute. You cannot. You can try, but a good critic will know the difference. They know, because they're not only looking at their food, they're also looking at the food at all the tables around them. And some of them, I know for a fact, also bring in ghost tables. They'll bring in two or three different tables at the same time and report back.
Sure.
So once you realize that, it goes, well, the review matters, but then the review doesn't matter. The only review that matters is my review as a restaurateur, because I'm going to be here every day. So if you truly are working towards perfection, or your definition of it, every day, that's all we can ask for in any walk of life.
Great. Thank you. Drew and David, we're going to have to hear from you guys in the second segment. Sam, time flies. We've already been on almost half an hour. Thank you so much for being with us, Sam.
Thank you, Sam.
Of course.
And we're going to take just a short break here. We'll be right back with David Waltuck, Drew Neuporent, Alex Stupak, Hannah Raskin, and joining us for the second half will be Eater New York critic Ryan Sutton. We'll be right back. We'll be right back.
Through mom and pop operations since 2006, the Brooklyn Kitchen provides the tools that shape our food culture. They stock a curated variety of pots, pans, knives, small appliances, and other kitchen essentials. Their grocery department works closely with local farms and food artisans to bring you the tastiest fresh produce, dairy, and pantry items. Their teaching kitchens allow them to offer a wide breadth of cooking classes, from knife skills to pig butchering, from cooking for couples to pickling and canning, from home brewing to pie making. Something new is always happening at the Brooklyn Kitchen. Visit them at 100 Frost Street in Williamsburg, Brooklyn, or visit thebrooklynkitchen.com.
Welcome back to The Front Burner with Jimmy and Andrew. We are talking chefs and critics today. And again, in the studio here, we have restaurateur Drew Neuporent, chefs David Waltuck and Alex Stupak. On the phone, Hannah Raskin of the Post and Courier. And joining us for the second segment is Ryan Sutton, Peter, New York restaurant critic. Ryan, are you there?
I am here. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for joining us. So, Ryan, you're coming in kind of mid-show here. You've been listening, I believe. Why don't we just give you a couple of minutes here, anything that maybe you'd like to pick up on or comment on from the last half hour?
No, I'm here to listen. I'll let you guys start off, and then I'll jump in as you have questions.
Okay. Well, then let's go right to one of the things I queued up at the top of the show. It seems like to a lot of people there's a and I'll come to Hannah in a second because I'm very curious to know if this is sort of New York myopia on our parts. But there's a real feeling that that fine dining, at least traditional fine dining, a lot of chefs feel like it's a little bit under siege. Like there's a real desire to sort of almost put a stake through the heart of fine dining. You know, the Per Se review happened a few weeks ago. The next day on Grub Street, there was a piece saying this is another nail in the coffin. You know, you go back to when Gabriel Kreuther opened his restaurant in the summer. A lot of the reviews didn't come till the fall, and they were almost universally superlative reviews. All of them, almost every single one, maybe every single one, framed it as fine dining isn't dead. Hold on just a minute. Fine dining's not quite dead. Instead of just saying this is a great restaurant. So I'm really curious, Ryan, to just hear your thoughts about this. Is this a type of dining that you feel needs to go, that you feel has kind of run its course, that you feel it's still there's still room for it in the mix? What's your just sort of disposition towards it?
I don't think anyone thinks fine dining is really dead. There's room in this city for all of us. I was at Le Bernardin maybe about a month ago. I went in between Christmas and New Year, typically a fairly slow time for restaurants. I showed up at the bar maybe around 9:50 in the evening, pretty late for a midtown institution, pretty late for a traditional fine dining white tablecloth institution where half the stems and the tables are made out of Zalto, which is going to cost you $60 if you buy one in a retail store. And the place was packed. Now, of course, just because a place is packed, inductive reasoning, it doesn't mean that fine dining is dead. But over the course of the past year or so of the various institutions that I visited, they haven't been suffering from any type of business. You know, walk into Gabriel Kreuther on any given night in Midtown, and it's filled with people who wear suits and who want to go out and want to have a full traditional culinary experience. They realize, however, that they're going to spend a little bit more for that in the contemporary 2016 world, because not only are food costs at an all-time high, albeit stable, but labor costs, as we all know, are going up and will continue to go up. And so, therefore, obviously, as prices go up, certain consumers are going to be, I don't want to say they're fired from these restaurants, but they're going to be shifted downward a little bit, and they're going to look for, you know, certain more values. They're going to look towards the a more stripped-down experience like, you know, the chef's counter at Empeon Cucina. They're going to look to where it's $165 per person for the second seating and $95 for the second seating. They're going to look to Blanca, which is $195 per person, versus something more elaborate at Per Se, which is $325 service included. So, yeah, I mean, as the world goes on, you know, certain things are inevitable. Death, taxes, inflation. As prices go up, fine dining becomes more expensive, and a certain consumer shifts downward just a tiny bit. But this is all part of the natural evolution. And these restaurants right now that are stripped down and more affordable, they will inevitably also become more expensive because they need to pay their employees more, and because eventually their clientele will grow a little older, and sometimes they'll become a little bit more comfortable. So this is all a cycle. No, there's never going to be an end to fine dining. There will always be younger, stripped-down restaurants and older, more plush and comfortable restaurants, and that's just the way the world works.
So I'm just curious. I just want to quickly pick up on something you said, and then we'll go to Hannah with this. But, you know, there was a lot of talk about cost threaded through what you just said. It's really interesting to me, and the Times Review of per se was very interesting to me. He had that line about, you know, one of the worst food deals in New York City. You know, and I know Drew and David and probably Jimmy will remember this, but years ago when Ruth came in as a critic at the New York Times, Brian Miller wrote a very famous letter that found its way into the public eye. And a big part of the letter he wrote was there was a lot of upset that price was factoring so much into the review. And now it seems to be really a major focus of criticism. I'm just wondering, when you started reviewing, has this always for you, this question, I guess I would call it a value, is that something that's always for you been a part of what you're there to comment on and a very important part of your job as you see it?
Yes, I mean, without a doubt. I mean, listen, I mean, this is specifically relating to me. This is a product of a number of factors. It's a product of the fact that I used to work at a place called Bloomberg, which is, of course, an organization that that earns its money off of, for lack of a better term, a data transparency. You know, the job of Bloomberg was to take opaque financial markets and inject transparency into them. And by the same token, I viewed my job as a reviewer, specifically within that organization, to do the same. I continued that here at Eater, where I work right now. Just by the same token, just being a, you know, a blue-collar guy, growing up in a blue-collar family up on Long Island, you know, a story I often like to tell, the first tasting menu experience I ever had was at a WD-50. It was a lovely meal. It was before Stupak joined that restaurant. The restaurant, of course, is now closed. But I went in November of 2005, had a lovely meal. Tasting menu was around $95, around 12 courses, one of the best culinary experiences of my life. Came back home. My father asked me two questions. He said, where do you go tonight? I said, WD-50, had a lovely meal. The second question he asked me was, how much did it cost? And I said, it was about $180 after wine pairing, tax, and tip. And he didn't speak to me for the rest of the evening because, you know, it was obviously an absurd amount of money for him. And the reason I tell that story so often is because even for a lot of us who go out to eat on a fairly regular basis, and we know that if we go to an a la carte restaurant, we're probably going to spend, you know, dinner after tax and tips is going to be about $140 or two. If we go to a tasting menu restaurant, it's probably going to be in the ballpark of anywhere from $300 to $500 or two. But for a lot of people who aren't integrated, who aren't part of this culinary world, which is, quite frankly, a whole lot of America, even the notion of a $95 tasting menu cheap to a lot of us is unaffordable for them. And so price transparency, at least for me, it's been a huge part of reviews. And if we want to get more people into this gastronomic fold, the question they're asking is not only how will you be entertained and what is this food going to taste like, their number one question is how much is it going to cost?
Right.
Because they simply aren't used to paying $18 for an appetizer, even though that might be cheap to some of us in the culinary industry.
Sure. Hannah, just I'd like to get back to the original question, and then we'll bring it into the studio here. But this question of fine dining and this whole topic of it, you know, I was looking through some of your reviews, and I saw your review of the Peninsula Grill. And you said, and I'm going to quote you here, remains an ideal restaurant for feting your parents' 50th anniversary or inducting your children into the realm of fine dining. And, you know, as a New Yorker, to hear that paragraph and not have a sentence at the end that said, before it disappears, or if you're into, mid-18th century history, or, you know, is this whole topic sort of a myopic thing for us here? Is this something you've spent time in Dallas, you've been in Seattle. Do you see this even as an issue in other places where you've worked?
Absolutely. This is an issue nationally. This is not a New York issue. A fine dining is fading. There's no question. I think perhaps Charleston being what Charleston is and has always been, there is certainly affection for fine dining and anticipation for its return. I would say, though, everything Ryan said is right. This is an economics thing. You know, if you open a restaurant and you're the only restaurant in town, you can afford white tablecloths and you can afford to get them laundered every night. I mean, that is an incredible expense no one's going to do that now, let alone where are they going to find the staff? You know, we have the same understaffing problem every city in the country has. So, I mean, they can't even find a sous chef. I don't know where they're going to find the guy just to fill your bread basket. It's not realistic to have the kind of fine dining we used to, because patrons don't go to the same restaurant on every Friday night. They want to go to the next new restaurant. And Lord knows in Charleston, we have a lot of them. So the people like fine dining. I don't think it's realistic, but I do think what's happening here is there are two things. One, I think even the restaurants that don't have the white tablecloth, that don't have the flowers, and I will say Fig, one of our most important restaurants, is in the midst of renovation now. And when they reopen next week, they will still have white tablecloths and they will have flowers, which I think is good for all of us. But so, yeah, a lot of restaurants don't. A lot of restaurants look like the restaurants you see in New York. But they still have perhaps a hostess who knows your name. You know, maybe the bread is free. They've kept some elements of it. And what I'm seeing that's most interesting is I think it's going to come back first where it's more affordable, which is at brunch and lunch. You know, you can't transform a dining room. You can't turn a burger joint into Peninsula Grill overnight. But I sort of feel like that's where it might happen first, where the service standards, where I just think that's kind of the focus right now.
Thank you, Hannah. That's a very insightful commentary to share with us.
That's a great comment.
I wanted to get the opinions of the people in the room. Start with David, and do you have something to share on this topic?
Yeah, I think so. I do think that there's an economic factor. I don't disagree with that. There are flourishes, and you mentioned white tablecloths, and you mentioned expensive glassware. There are things that are synonymous with fine dining that are expensive and that have nothing to do, in a sense, with the food that's on your plate. However, I mean, what do we mean by fine dining? There are extremely ambitious restaurants that are expensive, that aspire to do something very, very special in terms of food and service, that have decided, the owners, the restaurateurs, have decided to dispense with some of those flourishes, or many of those flourishes. But it's still, to me, in a sense, fine dining. It's trying to make a transcendent experience for an evening, or for a day, or for a moment, rather than to simply nourish you and have you feel like you've had a good meal and your belly is full and you're going home happy.
Yeah, you know, I'm just going to jump in because David, please, in 1979 redefined fine dining. Morachet in 1985 redefined fine dining. I was working at La Grenouille, Le Perigord, La Reserve. Undeniably, the French had the stranglehold of the city. And basically, when I found the space in Tribeca at $3,000 a month, it's what I could afford. And I couldn't afford a lot of amenities and a lot of the facades of all those little restaurants. So we got to the meat of the matter, which was the food. And arguably, David Boulay, as a chef in 1985, had a repertoire having worked at Robuchon or Verger, Waltuck the same way. So, but the point was, we redefined fine dining 30 years ago. Our thinking was, a lot of this is BS. A lot of this is a lot of French BS. And even though our inspiration, Chanterelle, Morachet, French words, and French wine lists, we started whole new horizons. There were no wine people in the restaurants. We've started the wine programs at Morachet and Chanterelle, and now every good restaurant in New York has redefined fine dining in the way of beverages with, you know, great spirit programs, great wine programs. My point is very simple. The economics is everything. Ryan's, he had the price hike. If you raise your price $1, he was on your case, right, Ryan? And quite frankly, let's just put it very simply. You get an egg sandwich someplace, it's your benchmark, it's really delicious, it costs you $6. Now the restaurant opens on Hudson Street, I won't name the restaurant, they're charging $12. Okay? It might be worth $12, it might be fantastic, but it is it has to be judged on the value and all of the dining experience. One thing about the restaurant industry, why this whole tipping thing, for instance, is such a scuttlebutt, is we've been really good about keeping our prices down. We tried to pass on, at least I did, the savings. That's why I charged $16 for dinner in 1985. We tried to pass on the savings to the guests. Guess what's happening now? The rent has skyrocketed. Minimum wage is being increased. Our cost of food and you know, artisanal products are very expensive. Guess what? The whole paradigm has changed. So there has to be another redefinition of fine dining.
Hey, okay. Thank you, Drew. I just, you know, it's interesting. It's there are these sort of tipping points in history of anything. I think in dining there are, you talk about the late 70s, early 80s, right? That was a huge, not just in New York, but around this country, a lot of young Americans coming in the business, moving, pivoting away from the classic French, definitely service model. Dress codes fell by the wayside. That was a very important couple of years, right? That seems to happen every so often. It does feel like we're in this period, a transitional period right now to some extent. This term fine dining, what does it mean? The tipping system, you know, maybe 20 years from now, that'll be something that's on its way into the dustbins of history in this business. You know, Alex, I'd love to hear from you on this in terms of, you know, for someone of your generation, whether speaking for yourself or if you want to speak more generally about sort of your peer group as you, you know, talk to them about these sort of things. I'd love to know what this term even means for you, and if it even really matters so much for you.
The term fine dining.
Fine dining, and if that really is even, does that even matter anymore, sure. What that means?
Well, I'll shift it from, if we're talking about fine dining as white tablecloths and flowers and polished silverware, those types of things, I'm going to think about it more in terms of best dining or the ultimate experience right. That people are seeking.
Yep.
We've talked a lot here about economic parameters. That's one thing. Ryan brought up the fact, well, these four-star restaurants are still busy. Another interesting point is that if those restaurateurs aren't opening more of them, they're not opening more of them, and they're not opening more of them for a reason. So I believe I have a tasting table, and I have the good fortune of actually getting to interact with my guests at a very deep and intimate level. I believe that definitions of luxury change. So I think once upon a time, a person wanted to wear the expensive suit and have the fancy corner office, and that was their definition of luxury at work. Now I think luxury is I don't have to get dressed up. I don't have to leave my house anymore.
Right.
So I think how that translates to food is like, I think the consumer is going, yeah, I want the good stuff. Give me the good stuff, but don't give me all that crap that you're wrapping it up in. Just give me the stuff.
And don't make me behave a certain way when I come in. Don't make me wear clothes I don't want to wear.
100%. I mean, I see people who are getting dressed up because they want to get dressed up, and I also see people eating at my tasting table wearing a Motorhead T-shirt. And it's not about, well, I had to get dressed up or I had to get dressed down. So I got to wear what I wanted to wear, and I don't have to feel bad about it. I don't have to feel ashamed. I don't have to feel like I don't fit in this environment. And that's where I see it all going. I mean, the people right now that are between 30, 35, 45, like that's what I'm seeing. That's the dialogue that I'm hearing. It's like, give me the good stuff. I don't want all that other crap around it. But that doesn't mean it's not fine dining. So to that point, I don't think fine dining is not dying. There's still always going to be an ultimate experience, and sure. There's also going to be an awesome, you know, $4 experience. It's just what that is. I mean, art changes, music changes, everything changes, and definition of luxury changes with it.
Yeah. I mean, it is interesting. There, I really do feel like this is sort of a pivot point. You know, there's this little cluster of restaurants in the East Village. You know, there's Fung Tu and Uncle Boone's and Narita, very casual restaurants, really good food, and those are all people who came out of Per Se. I mean, that's a very interesting and mostly directly.
Well, a lot of that goes back to, like, look, you worked at restaurants, you're a chef, now you're trying to break out on your own. The reason there's so many creative restaurants in the East Village specifically is because it's one of the few places where the rent is still low.
Right.
Lower than Brooklyn.
Sure. We have a little bit under 10 minutes here. I'd love to maybe talk, you know, a couple of references have been made to stars in the last few minutes. Three-star this, two-star that, whether it's a three- or four-star restaurant. You know, in a time when, in this restaurant landscape that Alex was just describing, I'd love to know, and I'd love to start with you, Hannah, and then Ryan, and then we'll come back into the room here. But, you know, this issue of, you know, a star system that really was sort of created at a time when a lot of restaurants at the upper end of restaurants, call it the best dining to use Alex's phrase, all sort of played by very much the same rules. I'd love to know how you guys feel about a star system and if that's something that we think we might also end up transitioning away from in the future, is something that just doesn't really work for a world in which so many, in which restaurants, excellent restaurants, can come in so many different shapes and sizes. Hannah, could you maybe speak to that? And I'm going to just ask everyone to maybe keep to about a minute because we're getting down toward the end of the show.
Sure. So I come from an all-weekly background, and we didn't use stars. I'm not crazy about the star system. Readers really like them. They keep track of them. We have a system here where we rate things separately. We rate the food separately from the ambiance. I still rewrote what the stars meant when I got here to try and take out any of that bias toward, you know, a traditional restaurant. So it is a little bit more. Listen, when I tell the restaurateurs who are upset about it, whatever, I say, the best I can do is 1, 2, 3, 4 stars. It's kind of like when you go to a ball game. You know, you got single, double, triple, you know, home run. Everyone knows what that means. That's kind of the best way I have to explain what we've got. I don't love the system, and I don't know how much it's moving us forward.
Thank you. Ryan, a quick thought from you on this?
Okay, you know, I could go either way on the issue. I mean, yes, I don't mean to sound too, I don't know what the right word is. They bring in a little bit of traffic, and they bring in a reader, and that's important in the business of journalism. That said, as a writer, you naturally want to have the reader focus on your words, and so there has to be some sort of, you know, middle ground between those, you know, two extremes. Generally speaking, as a critic, you know, I support, I use the 4-star system, 1 being good, 2 being very good, 3 being, you know, excellent, and 4 being outstanding. Of course, there's a lot of subjectivity within those parameters, but, you know, food criticism is not a subjective field. Generally speaking, what I like to do as a critic is that I hope that my 4-star reviews aren't necessarily a product of Le Bernardin's and the Danielles of the world, even though they might necessarily merit those ratings. And again, I had a 4-star experience at Le Bernardin not too long ago. But you want to, as a critic, slightly change those norms of what fine dining means and what a 4-star restaurant means. And probably my most kind of envelope-pushing 4-star review recently was Samia, which is a Michelin-starred restaurant in South Williamsburg, which charges $85 for a vegetable-heavy tasting of about 10 or so courses that's served in a much leaner environment than you would expect at, say, Danielle Le Bernardin or Per Se. So again, just as we have changing notions of luxury, we're going to have changing notions of what the star system means. Does it mean we'll have to do away with it? I don't think so. Again, I like it from a traffic standpoint. And just as long as we can continue to evolve with those star means, I think we're in good shape.
Thank you, Ryan. David, do you have something to share on this?
I'll try to be as brief as possible. Chanterelle got reviewed 7 times by the New York Times. We got 2 stars and 4 stars and 3 stars. I mean, there's a built-in and understandable hypocrisy. From my point of view as a chef and as a restaurateur, you know, you love the stars when you get 4 stars. You don't love them as much when you get 2 stars. I mean, but I from as objective a point of view as I can possibly take, I don't care for them at all. And while I think that what happens is that people only remember the stars and they don't really remember the review. Whereas I can quote you lines from, you know, the Mimi Sheridan review that I got in 1979 or 1980. So those resonate with me. I mean, the hypocrisy, you know, really goes beyond that to the point of what I can't remember who said it, but everybody knows, any restaurateur, any chef with aspirations and ambitions will know when the critic looks like and when they're there. What you do with that is, you know, another question. But if we could just get rid of the stars, I think it would be better.
Yeah, I think people should just read the reviews. I don't see stars attached to the New York Times Theater reviews. And you know, I've done very well with the stars, but it puts us all in one big fishbowl. I remember when Mimi Sheridan was the critic, you had Sammy's Romanian had 4 stars. The Palm had 4 stars. And admittedly, there was a different era. But I think it's important to read the review, and I agree with David that a lot of times people look at a review, they see a one star, and they move on. They feel, oh, I'm not going to eat in a one-star restaurant, and they don't even read the review, which is unfortunate. Of course, the whole thing's changed a great deal now, and everyone's a critic, and there's a whole, you know, blogosphere out there of people writing in. And by the way, TripAdvisor and even OpenTable has probably the stupidest system I've ever seen, because people, you know, rape you in those things, and you still get 3 stars. So it just confuses the system.
All right. Just quickly, Alex, because we're down to our last couple of minutes, do you have a quick thought to share?
Very quick. I'm divisive on it. I actually find the stars incredibly entertaining, and they add a certain element to the review. On the inverse, though, I think the bummer is that, again, like people see one star and they look at it as a negative. There are awesome one-star restaurants.
Yeah. There used to be the one-star love letter. William Grimes at the New York Times specialized in the one-star love letter.
And again, being a business person now, I mean, economically, I'll take a one-star and a two-star that's cranking any day.
Right.
Yeah, I got one of those one stars in 1999.
That was a love letter.
16 years ago. Yeah.
The only thing I'll say very quickly.
Just quickly, Drew, because we're going
to
get included.
But people, when they open a restaurant, they aspire to something. And not everyone aspires to 3 or 4 stars. And then the problem that I see with the critics is sometimes they ascend people to 3 or 4 stars, and they're not even ready for that.
So. Great point.
Okay. With that, I want to thank everybody for being here. That was a packed hour. We're technically a 45-minute show. We were lucky enough to go right up against the show that follows us at noon. But just quickly, I'd like to thank Sam Sifton, who was here at the beginning. Hannah Raskin. Hannah, good to meet you over the phone. Thank you for being here.
Thank you, Hannah.
Ryan, thank you very much. Ryan Sutton from Eater New York.
Thank you.
Here in the studio, Drew Neuporent, David Waltuck, and Alex Stupak. Everybody, again, our huge thanks for, I think, what I thought was a useful conversation about a topic that I think it was just great to get some critics and some chefs and a restaurateur together on this and just hash it out a little bit. So thank you all for being here. We're going to dispense with our usual housekeeping notes today. So for the Front Burner, I'm Andrew Friedman.
And I'm Jimmy Bradley.
We'll see you back next week. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archive programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.